You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNRadio.com. And be sure to share.
Hi, just a couple of housekeeping notes before we start. Although the Second City's live theater and live classes are not happening, we have turned everything virtual. You can take Second City classes in writing, in improv, and acting. There's a kids camp. We're also doing virtual corporate webinars and keynotes and workshops. It's all really kind of amazing, everything that we've been able to turn around. Plus, Second City is offering live improv shows on Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. You can get all that information at www.secondcity.com. Check it out. The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting the Yes And.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another letter left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The corner of the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Casper Terkyle. Casper is the co-host of the award-winning podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text, a ministry innovation fellow at Harvard Divinity School, co-founder of the startup Sacred Design Lab, and former director of possibility at the On Being Impact Lab. His work has been featured in the New York Times, Boston Globe, The Atlantic, and The Washington Post, and on PBS and Vice. He is the co-author of the seminal paper How We Gather, and has presented his research at venues like the Aspen Ideas Festival, Institute for the Future, and Cannes Lions International Festival of Creativity. He has a new book. It's called The Power of Ritual, Turning Everyday Activities into Soulful Practices. Casper, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Kelly. Great to be here.
So the last 3 weeks of podcast tapings have painted a sometimes troubling and sometimes inspiring look at the world as it is and the world as it could be. Jacqueline Novogratz talked to us about her manifesto for moral courage. Mauro Guillen talked to us about how the world will look in 2030 and how the population shift to cities means we are both closer to each other than ever before, but also more unconnected to our communities than ever before. And Joseph Badaracco invited us to step back and give weight to the power of pondering and reflection. And then I started reading your book, which feels like it touches on every one of these points.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, I need to speak with all of these people. No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I wrote the book really in the context of two kind of big shifts and then reflecting what it means for us as individuals. One is the kind of drastic shift away from religious institutions. So this process of disaffiliation that more and more of us, especially in the US, describe ourselves as non-religious or disconnected from a religious institution. And at the same time, this other kind of trend of the growing rates of loneliness and social disconnection. And so I think we find ourselves in the middle of this moment where a lot of the ways in which traditionally we were held in community, the ways in which we found meaning and purpose are kind of floating away. And we're having to figure that out ourselves. And that isn't always easy.
And Mauro pointed this out when we interviewed him, that the present moment we find ourselves in, and I'm talking about everything from the social revolution that's happening to the pandemic, that's just an accelerant for these ideas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. In multiple ways. I mean, one way is that kind of disappearance of traditional religious institutions. You know, many organizations are laying off people. We'll see a closure of an even larger number of churches, for example, because of COVID. But at the same time, it's a turn towards meaning. And I think a moment of cultural reckoning where we're asking ourselves, especially, you know, white people like myself, you know, is this how we want to live? Is this what it's like? But also within the context of COVID, you know, was the way in which we worked healthy? Were the relationships that we have the right ones? So it's a real moment, I think, of reckoning on a moral and an economic kind of plane.
So on a lighter note, and you start the book with, so I have a go-to movie. You both have go-to movies.
Yes.
So I probably watch this movie every few months or so, and I use it as a tonic. I use it as a touchstone. I ran a video store like in the 80s, so this is Whoa. Like, this is stuck with me.
It's well, what's the
for,
movie?
It's Bill Forsyth's Local Hero. Which I don't know if it's a small film, Scottish film, with Peter Reichert and Burt Lancaster in one of his last roles. And it very much speaks to a busy oil executive who connects with a small Scottish town that he's attempting to buy, and then is seduced by the joy, the reality, the love of nature. You have a different go-to movie.
I feel like my go-to movie does not compare to yours. So
it's okay.
I'm going to have to try and defend it. Yeah, my go-to movie is the incredible movie You've Got Mail with mm-hmm. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, which I am told is some people's least favorite Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie.
Oh, no.
But they are wrong. But you're exactly right. You know, I think we turn towards these movies, not even really necessarily because the movie itself, but because the layers of meaning that they have accrued every time we've watched them. So, you know, for me, this became my movie when I was a closeted teenage boy in a, you know, English boarding school, surrounded by 50 testosterone-fueled teenagers. And this was my kind of escape to a world that one day might be mine. And I do now live in New York, although Brooklyn instead of Manhattan. So, you know, the dream is still not quite attained. But we have, I think, a lot of us who have, maybe it's a favorite piece of music or a favorite movie or a book that we turn to again and again. It's not just the movie, it's how we engage with it. So for me, I'm very strict. You know, I watch it on my own because I'm inevitably, you know, going to go through all sorts of emotions and I want to feel completely safe expressing them. Sure. And I always have it with a tub of Haagen-Dazs ice cream. So, you know, I'm a real stickler for how I watch it.
That's great. I actually posted a quote from your book on LinkedIn that got a big response, including my friend Colleen, who ordered it. And it's a long one, but I want to read it because I think it speaks to the heart of the book. Quote, "We've been taught to see the world as divided between the sacred and the profane, the religious and the secular. We've been taught that there's somehow a line that makes a church building sacred and a supermarket secular. That vertical line is an invention. Instead, imagine a horizontal line between the shallow and the deep. It stretches across every place and every person. When we can sink below the blur of habit, we can be present to that portion of the experience where we find deepest meaning." So beautiful writing, but also this to me gets at the heart of what you're talking about, which is finding our love, our hope, our journey in the everyday.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I was really inspired by that idea by the 20th century theologian Paul Tillich. You know, for me, it's such a reorientation to how I grew up thinking about the world. You know, I wasn't religious growing up. I grew up in a pretty secular family. But certainly as a gay teenager, you know, religion was something that was either, you know, irrelevant or cruel. And so I just assumed it wasn't going to be part of my life. And as I've grown older, I think we just have moments of experience, you know, whether it's holding a newborn in our arms or maybe it's, you know, you're looking out across a mountaintop, or there are just moments when we feel connected to something bigger or something deeper. And the usual way of thinking about the world is insufficient to hold that majesty or to hold that depth. And so thinking about spirituality, not you know, that it belongs to a certain institution or that it belongs to a certain place, but to think about it instead as something that's constantly present. And it really is about how aware of it we are in each individual moment. And not that we're necessarily going to live in a constant daze of sacredness. You know, we have to do the laundry, we have to do the cooking. Although, of course, those can be sacred moments too. But just that sense that there's nothing that can separate us from that deeper truth, right? It's just our awareness or you know, the capacity we have to be present with it. That's really the thing that separates us from it.
So one of the things you talk about is sacred reading.
Yes.
And I mean, I grew up in a house of books. I live in a house of books. I love them. Before we talk about sacred reading and in particular Harry Potter, I think it would be disingenuous at this moment not to just take a moment and talk about the sort of truly disappointing, dispiriting comments that J.K. Rowling is continuing to make about the trans community. And I've heard, you know, I've listened to the podcast. I know this is a great pain.
It is.
For our audience, just give us a sense of where you sit right now with this.
Yeah. I mean, there's much to say, and I'll try and keep it brief. I mean, the context is that Harry Potter, for a generation of readers, and it's been going, you know, 20 years now since the first books came out, for a generation of readers, especially folks who felt marginalized or that they didn't belong in some way, the Harry Potter books have been a remarkable set of stories in which a lot of young people have found safety. Child psychiatrists have talked about when they invite someone in therapy to imagine a safe place, often they'll think of Hogwarts. There's a particular love, especially from young queer kids, for these books, because of course Harry is born an orphan, he's an outsider, right? Like there's so many parallels. And J.K. Rowling over the last few years has increasingly been vocal really about a sort of an anti-trans outlook, which has been extremely hurtful, and especially, of course, to trans fans and readers. And one of the things that I'm extremely grateful for is that with our podcast, where we read Harry Potter as a sacred text, from the beginning, we have always said, sacred reading is not about authorial intent. We're not trying to discover what does she mean or why does this plot not work or what does this character, you know, represent to the author. For us, sacred reading is always about how can we use this story, how can we use this text to help us live lives of greater integrity and courage. You know, what can we learn from these characters about how to live? And so to some extent, you know, we're protected from the immediate, you know, hurtful speech coming from J.K. Rowling. But at the same time, you know, when you love something so dearly and the person who's created it betrays you, it's incredibly painful. And so, you know, for some people, Harry Potter isn't that safe place anymore.
Right. The connection my family has to this is our daughter Nora and our son Nick loved these books. Mm. Nora read them multiple times, and in the last month of her life in the hospital, the only thing that would help her go to sleep was listening to the Jim Dale audiobook. And so this connection I have, which is a very sacred, sad, but a very sacred period of time, this was a soundtrack. I wrestle with it because that can't be erased. Our meaning. It was art for us in that room. And you actually write in this chapter, unconnected to this situation, quote, narratives of good and evil nearly always are more complex when we risk our hearts to explore a sacred reading.
Oh yeah, doesn't that suck? I mean, this is one of the things. This is one of the things that I've learned, you know, from being in divinity school, where perhaps when I first started thinking about sacred texts, to me it kind of meant perfect text, you know, that somehow this text was free of fault and everything in it was good. That is not the truth, right? And when we learn about communities that gather around a text like the Bible or the Torah or the Quran, they have to wrestle with some really ugly parts of it, you know, and from my theological perspective, what makes a text sacred is not that there is a God on high who points to a certain book and says, you know, this is the almighty and inerrant text. It's not a prescriptive text. It's a descriptive text, right? It tells us about what life is like in its ugliness and its beauty. And so when we're doing sacred reading, we're not looking for clean and easy answers. It's actually important to know that the ugliness in these texts is just a representation of the ugliness and the difficulties that's just all around us in our lives.
Yeah, during the sort of grief journey, I was finding myself, Tillich I was definitely reading, Viktor Frankl I was reading. I mean, there's so much poetry, so much for Adrian Rich. And the combination of the ability to sit in our garden and sort of commune with nature, music, which is also very important to us, and these books, became part of the healing process. And it didn't mean that that one part of you isn't still broken, but that's the world that we actually live in. It is both at all times. And I really felt like, I want to talk a bit about this 12th century monk who I did not know. Is it Guigo? Is that how you pronounce it?
That's how I say it. I haven't met him, but that's how I pronounce it. Yeah. Oh, Guijo. That's my other favorite go-to. Guijo the Second. Yeah, this was a wonderful teacher. He was a Carthusian monk, and he wrote a little pamphlet. And honestly, it's just a few pages long, and it's very readable. And it's called The Ladder of Monks. Mm-hmm. And in it, what he's trying to do is to help his readers who are reading the Bible to engage with the text, not just as a narrative or a story, but to kind of gain a more mystical understanding of what's going on with it, or to go to a deeper meaning. And so he offers these four stages of reflection. Now, the way that we present it is a little bit of a transliteration, but I think it helps us do the practice better. So he calls it sacred reading, Lectio Divina. It's just the Latin for sacred reading. Mm-hmm. And he offers us these four reflection steps. And so first of all, you take a little snippet of text. It might be a sentence or a word. And you first of all read it, you know, what does it mean narratively? This is the way we usually read, right? What's going on in the book? Who's there? Where are they? What's happening? Very simple. But then, and he compares this to kind of putting a grape into your mouth and biting into it and all of the juices kind of exploding and in this delicious mix. He says, I want you to read it again, usually out loud, and then to think of, you know, what allegorical meanings does this connect you to? You know, if you're reading, for example, the first sentence of the Harry Potter books, right? We learn about Mr. and Mrs. Dursley and that they live at number 4 Privet Drive. So you might think about what does the number 4 remind you of? Or it could be the four Beatles or the four horsemen of the apocalypse, or the number 4 is sometimes used as a letter A in text messages, right? It's really about expanding. It's kind of very improv-y, honestly.
Yeah.
so you're really stretching your imagination. You're opening your mind and your heart. And then here comes the third question, which is to ask yourself, what in my life am I reminded of by this piece of text? Is there an experience that I've had that connects with what's on the page here? And so suddenly we're going not just from the Wizarding World or whatever text you're using, as you said, poetry or other fiction, but we're bringing it home to our life and to our experience. So that then for the final question, which traditionally Guijo would ask, what is God asking you to do through this text? The way that we ask it in the podcast is to ask ourselves, you know, what is the text asking of me? And so we've gone through a kind of action and reflection process, which brings us to a place where maybe we're making a decision to give our sister a call who we haven't spoken to in a while. Or, you know, we've had listeners tell us about really big decisions like choosing to adopt a child or leave a marriage or, you know, start a new career. All of what this text study is about is to help us understand our own life, our own experience, the world around us, so that these sacred texts are not just an escape, you know, though they can be that, and that's wonderful, but that they're a tool to help us live more deeply in the world as it is.
I thought it was interesting, too, that by interrogating the text in this manner, you found empathy for Mrs. Dursley.
Well, again, this is what's so frustrating about sacred reading. it's not easy. You know, you end up in situations where having made certain, you know, decisions to like or not like someone, and, you know, sometimes very clearly that's the author's idea, suddenly through the lens of our own experience, we can see a whole new side or a perspective of what's going on in the story. So Mrs. Dursley is, I should be very clear, the Dursleys are abusive to Harry, right? He lives under a staircase. I mean, it's horrible, horrible things. And at the same time, we suddenly realize, oh gosh, she's a young mother. She's already got a one-year-old. She's been told that her sister, who she's had this very complicated relationship with, has been killed, as has her brother-in-law. And now she's responsible for this child that she did not want. And there's a sort of hanging threat over her that, you know, she has to care for this child. And so suddenly, there was an empathy in us as readers that there hadn't been before when we were just reading the page. So it's a way to enrich the world. You know, if you think about St. Ignatius, another wonderful kind of Catholic teacher, what he did with readers of the Gospels was to invite people to imagine themselves into the scene, you know, if they're walking next to Jesus, to feel the salty waters and to smell the fish of the fishermen. we could do the same with the Harry Potter books or any other stories, to imagine ourselves to see and touch and feel and taste that world that, that the story is based in. And suddenly things come to life. We might even notice characters who weren't there before, right? We might see colors or a fruit on the table, you know, who knows? But it enriches the story and it helps us make meaning then ultimately of our own lives too.
So in addition to sacred reading, you talk about Sabbath time and in three applications, tech, solo, and play and creativity. Let's actually start with tech, because I think that's the easiest one for us all to relate to.
Absolutely.
you talk about Kevin Kelly, a technologist who I was only mildly aware of, but actually I've been digging into, really, really smart guy, who says it takes every new technology a decade before society comes to consensus on what etiquette we need to tame it. I mean, I've said for ages that we don't know yet the seatbelt we need for our iPhones.
Absolutely. I mean, the classic example, and I think I mentioned this in the book, is that when mobile phones were invented, you know, the idea of having a silent ringer took 10 years to develop. You know, people had to be frustrated in the library of phones going off for a decade before that feature was built in. And you're exactly right. You know, we're still navigating how to be responsibly engaging with technology. And it's not about, you know, throwing these tools away. They're powerful, amazing things, but our relationship to them is just not quite yet in right relationship, as it were. We're overpowered by them. And so one way for me that's been really a joy, honestly, is practicing a tech Sabbath. So very much inspired by the Jewish tradition of Shabbat. On Friday night, I turn off my phone and I turn off my laptop. I physically hide them because otherwise I'm too tempted to go back online. And I light a little candle and I stand there in the middle of my living room and I sing a little song that I learned in summer camp. And for me, it's a moment when I kind of cross a little bridge from the world of busyness and productivity to a world of rest. And what I loved most about learning about the tradition of Sabbath, and especially from Abraham Joshua Heschel, great 20th century theologian and rabbi, usually we think about digital detoxes or turning off tech as a time of restoration or recharging our batteries. And what these scholars and teachers tell us is that no, the Sabbath is the apex of the week. It's not a time of preparation. The work week is the time of preparation so that we can live in this taste of heaven, or as he describes it, a cathedral or a palace in time. And so the Sabbath becomes not just a moment of kind of renewal and rest, but it's the most delicious moment of living. And according to Jewish law, you know, we're supposed to have delicious food and be with the people we love. We're even supposed to make love on the Sabbath, right? So we're really supposed to indulge in all the goodness that life has to offer in that 25-hour time.
There's a really unique observation in this particular chapter that definitely ties to the world of improvisation. We've been doing some work at Harvard with Francesca Gino and Francis Frey, teaching the students in the sort of creativity class. And one of the things that Francis said to me the other day was that the thing that she found so astounding in the world of improvisation is our unrelenting messaging around the need to separate the creative act from judgment. The minute you start judging, you are no longer in a creative space. And you talk a lot about like just good enough. Like it's okay. Like this, the search for perfectionism is not going to help you in this world.
Well, and I think one of the things that I love about Sabbath is, for me, it kind of creates that container in which I can be mediocre, you know, and for me, especially about the creative arts. I grew up in a household, I grew up in a Waldorf school in my early years, and my sisters went through that system. And are you familiar with Waldorf?
My kids both went to Waldorf their entire... we're going to talk about Michaelmas. That's coming up.
Oh, I love Michaelmas so much. But it meant that I have three sisters who are incredibly talented musicians and painters and metal workers. I mean, I was so horribly ordinary compared to them. And so I've always been very shy about that. But in that moment of Sabbath time, when I literally have been kind of separated from the tools with which I might share a picture I've painted or a poem that I've written with the world outside, I can just create something for the joy of creating. And it's honestly probably a sad indictment of my life that I feel like everything I need to make has to be shared on social media, but I don't think I'm alone. and so it kind of creates that space, that permission to just make something for the joy of making it, and that it doesn't have to be more than that, right? The hobby doesn't have to become a side hustle, to use that phrase.
Right. So I will share this with you, because I did write in the notes about Michaelmas, and I was like, I wonder if he knows about Waldorf. So Christmas this year, which is our first Christmas without Nora, I was trying to figure out a thing, and not a big thing, but what I ended up doing was getting one of the copper candle holders that they use for the Nicholas clock, and I kept a candle lit throughout the day. That's what I did.
It's so beautiful.
And it was like, it was a little hard. It was very easy to do, but it like, you know, that's the, I knew she carried that. And it connected to that school, which meant so much to her. And was like, sort of like, I don't know if that's going to be the ritual every year. I suspect it might. But I think the Waldorf community, what is so lovely about that is there just, you mean the Maypole and the May dancing and all this ridiculous, like, eurythmia that everyone makes fun of. There's actually on the web, I don't know if you've caught this on the web, there is some sites that are just eurythmy jokes.
Oh, amazing. I hated that so much as a kid.
Yeah.
And of course, now I'm like, oh, okay, I get it more.
So terrible. All right. So,
but Kelly, can I, if I may, I just want to lift up some really beautiful elements that you brought together just in that really simple act. You know, sometimes when we think about spirituality, or we think about, you know, to use this divinity school phrase of meaning making, it can feel very abstract, or it can feel very difficult to do. And what you did in lighting that candle was illustrate, like, first of all, how simple things like this can be, but also how within our imagination and our grasp things like this are, that kind of ritual making, that just lighting a candle and have it burn throughout the day meant that Nora was present. You know, she was there with you in spirit in some way, and that it took was for you to say, okay, I want to find some way to, you know, I want to find a way to mark this. I want to find a way to make this invisible feeling, this invisible knowledge of truth, make it visible. And that lighting a candle could do that. I think it's a profound and beautiful example of exactly what the book is about.
I've talked about this in the podcast before, but I'll mention it briefly because I think you'll find it interesting. So my wife, who is a comedy professor, she runs the first BA in comedy writing performance in the country, and also a longtime Second City Improv director and teacher, had come up with an exercise for a workshop that she was doing around resilience. And in these virtual environments, right, we feel stuck. She's trying to get people out of that. So she has this exercise called Wish, where she has people get a piece of paper and write down something they wish they could do right now. So I would write down, like, swim in the ocean. And then she has, no, write down the emotion that you think you would have with that. Like, I would be refreshed. And then the third column is, what is something else you could do to feel that emotion? So, like, putting water on your face, you know, taking a walk. And you start to realize that that we are overcomplicating our nearness to holy things, if you want to call them that, or sacred things that we actually, they are within our grasp. We just have to human beings do this all the time, right? We just make everything too complex.
Absolutely. Oh, that's a beautiful exercise. And I think it's I'm just reminded, you know, of the tradition within religious life of kind of stepping back from the world to go more deeply into it. And
right.
Classic example would be a monastic life, where you're intentionally saying no to some things in order to say a bigger yes to something else. And amidst the, you know, obviously the horrific suffering and honestly, you know, federal mismanagement, that there are ways in which we can, you know, reconnect with the things that are most important to us. And perhaps rediscover, especially locally, you know, whether it's people going for walks around their neighborhood, actually find new things to fall in love with, or new places to think of as sacred places in our lives. So I love that exercise. I'm gonna take that away. Thank you.
Yeah, sure. So let's talk about this. I've talked a lot on the podcast, and certainly social scientists talk about our human beings craving connection. This Harvard study that's been going on for, God, 80 years, I think.
80 years, yeah.
And the scientists concluded that the quality of participants' relationships with their friends, families, and partners mattered most.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not money. It's not position. At the end of the day, it's our people.
Yeah.
So
frustratingly. Yeah. I wish it was simpler.
I don't know. And this is where you actually have some lovely examples. And I know about Lennon Flowers and her partner, Carla Fernandez, but talk to us about the dinner party, because that was also born originally in sort of a grief moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the dinner party is a community for people mostly in their 20s and 30s who've suffered significant loss. So perhaps the death of a parent or a sibling or a loved one of any kind. And it came about because a group of kind of acquaintances, really, new colleagues, all realized that they had lost a parent at a relatively young age, and that especially in our kind of dominant culture, there's very little space for grief. And Lennon Flowers, who's a dear friend and one of the co-founders, described it as, you know, when people might ask on Mother's Day or Thanksgiving, oh, you're going to see your mom? She'd say, well, actually, she's died. And it was kind of a conversation killer. People didn't know what to do with it. And so she yearned for a community of people who she could speak with, honestly, not just about the grief, but the kind of the fullness of emotions, right? The sadness and maybe the relief, the anger, the regret, the joy of the memories, and also just like the everyday, right? Even 3, 4, 5, 6 years later, when maybe the immediate pain of grief had passed, that life is still formed by that experience of loss. And all she did, and this is Lennon's genius, is that she invited people to get together around a dinner table and just to talk. And so to think of dinner as a kind of an invitational calling card in which people can build community. And the dinner party has now grown to, you know, hundreds of tables around the world, and an enormous hunger from people who've experienced grief to come together. And it's just one example, I think, of a whole new generation, really, of communities that are being built that are ostensibly secular, right? Yeah. They don't look spiritual or religious, but when you see what's happening, when you hear the conversations, when you learn what it means to people, to me, it started to look very congregational. And that meant that, you know, people who were leading these communities were being asked to do not just, you know, make sure that people show up at the right time and that they know where they're going, but they're being texted, you know, what do I do if I want to hurt myself? I think I should leave my husband. You know, all of these kind of pastoral questions that were being directed to leaders of communities like the dinner party, where in my eyes, you know, that looks like someone who's leading a religious community, where you're dealing with questions of ultimate meaning and concern. And so it's really interesting to think about this moment, not just as, oh, isn't it interesting to see these cool new communities pop up? But to me, they're examples really of a new generation of spiritual communities that are growing, even though they don't look ostensibly religious.
Well, and I think we talked about this when we met in Aspen. I mean, certainly the improv scene is an example of this.
Absolutely.
And what's very interesting, too, in terms of the reckoning that we're all dealing with now, because we're being rightly called out for the, you know, not anti-racist structures that existed, because these, you know, in the case of us, you know, we're a 60-year-old organization that was not built by people who had any, you know, idea about this. But what's happening is, like, it's a loving calling out, because it's challenging us to do better and to be better, and we're doing it. But but the thing is, you know, we are like maybe one of the only establishments, institutions that has enough, you know, structure, depth, financial resources to be able to do this. And I very much wonder what the theater world in general, the theater world, the improv world, what is this all going to look like when we're able to gather again? Because it's an incredible opportunity, but it's going to take a lot of hard work.
It is. I mean, and I will absolutely agree with you in the sense of like having to do a lot of learning and unlearning and then figuring out, okay, so what do we do differently? So in the organization I help run that really grew out of this research called Sacred Design Lab, you know, one of the things that we realized we could do, you know, we might not be able to change national policy, but every time that we hire someone who is descended from people who were enslaved, we decided, well, the least we can do is pay reparations. And so one of the things that we've instituted is to have the difference between income levels for Black and white Americans, which is, I think, 26.7%, to have that be the kind of additional reparational payment towards whether it's freelancers or staff members. And we're very small, you know, we're just three people. So it's a small scale. But I mean, the experience for me of learning about this, and even at the beginning, seeing it, it's like, oh, okay, so this is something like we can do that's good, you know, in addition to hiring people. And then being educated of like, actually, no, this is repaying a debt that we owe. And suddenly seeing it as an opportunity to live out our values and being able to repay that debt. I think for a lot of us, we're going to have to figure out what are the ways in our organizations, in our individual lives, in our families, that we can not only have these conversations, but start to implement actions that really shift things. Because ultimately, you know, my understanding of this is that it's a collective liberation issue, right? That none of us are free until all of us are free.
Yes.
And so we are bound up in it until we can get ourselves, all of us, out of it.
I'm going to ask you for your yes and story in a moment. But before we do that, I was really intrigued by this idea in the book that you talk about of decentering yourself.
Mm.
Because, you know, there's so much, so many people talk about the need to center oneself. But talk to us what you mean when you talk about decentering.
Yes. Well, Kelly, I don't know if you know anything about this, but I'm a very fascinating and interesting person. I really like being with myself most of the time. This might have, you know, something to do with being a white guy. But there's so much in our culture which is oriented around the individual. And, you know, even the notion of self-care, right? Like there's so much which is focused just on us and our own lives and, you know, self-knowledge, etc. And much of that is wonderful. But I think one of the biggest challenges is to remind ourselves that the world does not revolve just around us, and to have an experience in which our eyes are raised from the kind of immediate spot that we're standing on, and to remember that there is something much bigger all around us, right? That there are people and plants and animals and stars and galaxies, right? That there is something around us that's much bigger. And so practices for me that have become really important are things that help me remember that I'm part of something bigger. And so that moment of decentering from my own immediate needs and anxieties and stresses can also be a wonderful moment of remembering the kind of fundamental okayness of the world as it is, even amidst, you know, great suffering and joy, that this is where we are in this moment. And so whether that's looking up at the night sky, whether that's being lost in singing with other people, whether it's you know, maybe focusing on just looking at the lines on the back of our hand, you know, that there's so many ways in which we can kind of lose ourselves from just the intense internal scrutiny that we're usually submitting ourselves to. I think it's important to have a healthy balance of you know, practices and processes that help us look at ourselves, but also the world beyond ourselves.
Yeah, it's not unusual for like a beginning improv class. The very first exercise or few exercises are sort of standing in silence with the group and counting the bricks in a wall.
Mm.
And we're basically trying to get you out of your you know, judgment space and your thinking about yourself space, but also connecting to the room and the people around you. And it needs to be tactile, and it's not just intellectual, though it is that as well. Mm. So it's a lot of early improv is about unlearning, and sort of, I think is a similar idea. Okay. So we always ask our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, when groups of people are making something out of nothing, they don't get very far by saying no. They actually don't get anywhere. they don't really get very far just by saying yes. They have to say yes and. They have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. So I'm wondering if you have a yes and story for us.
Mm. Well, first of all, I want to come to one of your improv classes, Kelly.
Yeah,
this is so cool. So I met my now husband online when we both lived in Boston, and his family's from Kentucky. Definitely a more, you know, conservative, more religious context than I know and I grew up in. And culturally, we did not have a lot in common. But I learned that they are huge fans of the UK basketball team, which is an excellent basketball team. So the University of Kentucky team. And you know, I have a couple of sports that I follow. Basketball isn't one of them. Mm-hmm. But on discovering this, I was like, I have to invest. I want to make this relationship work. How can I say yes to this love that they have? I'm not really into shooting things. I'm not really into, you know, other things that are a big part of their cultural context. And so I was like, I'm going to become a huge UK fan. Maybe not all year round, but in March Madness, I'm going to paint my face blue. I'm going to wear the t-shirts. I'm going to watch every game. And I'm going to be more active in these text threads than they are themselves. So I went all in on March Madness, and it was one of the first things that was canceled during COVID, and I was genuinely sad, and it was just such a lovely lesson to realize, like, when you do say yes to something that maybe otherwise you'd say no to, you can fall in love with a whole new part of the world that otherwise you would, you know, would have passed me by.
I love that you yes-anded college basketball. The book is called The Power of Ritual: Turning Everyday Activities into Soulful Practices. Casper Turkile, thank you for coming on the show.
So glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Getting the S.A.N. is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is L.F. Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.